Hello and welcome to Everything in Between, the podcast where a dad and daughter duo delve deep into topics ranging from true crime to paranormal occurrences to urban legends and, well, everything in between. I'm Emma.
I'm the dad.
That's Anish. And it was a pretty relaxed weekend today. We have one big, like, topic that we want to talk about and then a few other, like, smaller things.
The weekend definitely was one particular binge.
Yes. So should we start with that?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, well, we watched the Ted Bundy Falling for a Killer docuseries on Amazon Prime, which, when did that come out? Did it just come out, or was it like a little bit before?
I think it was Friday.
Oh, really?
I believe it just came out.
And it was amazing. Like, it covered... It interviewed his longtime girlfriend, like, during the... And I don't think she's done much in the way of interviews besides...
I don't remember seeing her on... I mean, the early ones, way back, back in my day, definitely didn't. And then the main one that just came out, a couple...
Ted Bundy tapes?
Yeah, the Ted had nothing about her. I mean, they talked about her...
Yeah, but they didn't really...
Briefly, like...
Yeah, hardly, they focused more on him and... I think that this one was so good because it focused a lot on the victims. It interviewed the victims' families, and it talked about the feminist culture at the time, and really dove into that as well. And I think that was really powerful to see that.
I think from your point, I guess, to just kind of nail it even harder, is that it is one of the best documentaries I've seen. And to go further, though, to what you're saying about the feminist part, it's not even that. It's I think what they tried to do, and they did it well, and really, I think it's eye-opening, because I think what they were trying to say, or how to prove it, was that the reason this stuff happened and it went as far as it did, and even the way it was portrayed in every possible way, and everything it was written, every book afterwards, every article, everything about it was...
All the glorification.
It wasn't even the glorification. It was that at the end of the day, it still seemed that it was somehow the woman's fault.
Right.
In any way, not even the victim. It was every woman around him, somehow they were at fault, or they were led to believe it was their fault. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think... Every man in that was maybe a degree separated, right? The girlfriend's father, right?
That's so true. I forgot about that.
Yeah, and then the anybody that was a policeman assigned to the case, even the difference between the people who took the calls, if you were male or female, taking the calls, and then who actually placed the calls, it really just, and I mean, I'm not trying to make an excuse for the time, but when you're watching it, you know, the victims and the crimes in themselves are painful and, I mean, shock you to your core, but then there's this kind of cringeworthy thing around of where you're watching it and you're going, oh my God, you know, you're just dismissing, or how you dismiss, or how I was more angered, I think, by the scenarios of how much more those people who were fighting for it. Right. And I mean, I know this is confusing if you haven't seen it. So it's almost like you need to have a book club afterwards, but I guess the way I want to, maybe this will make the point clearer, is that some of the victims' friends who were then interviewed to explain or to talk about the victim in a way of, in an investigative point of view, both either from the police or by the reporters involved, they had to go out of their way to be more factual, to explain the situation, and to understand the fear that or portray the fear that they felt, and that at the end of the day, this woman's missing. Because I think that's the other part, right? They didn't find women, right? Women disappeared. Mm-hmm. So they had to fight almost to say that there's something wrong here.
Right.
Let's go find her. And even not, I mean, connecting the dots with the other people, I understand that part, that takes longer. But they had to fight to say, well, you know, is she with a boyfriend? Or,
yeah.
You know,
she's just a runaway.
Yeah, or yeah. Is she just, you know, I mean, it's a college campus. It's a girl. And, you know, there's guys here. So, like, could it be that? And then they're like, oh, and then they, oh, we found blood.
Yeah.
And they're not, to see that microcosm of time. And yes, the feminist movement is moving, and they make a point about how are they connected, and how, because there was like a rash of serial killers, and they don't go into much detail about other folks who were, hitchhiking and things like that. Whereas it was that a callous for like men to just be more angry kind of thing. But at the end of the day, that microcosm, and I think your mom kind of made that this point, is that it's almost being like we're revisiting history right now on this misogynistic, patriarchal kind of world of we're losing something again, and you know, let's tamp down these things. So it's great for the victims to be able to have their say. And I think, you know, we had this conversation and about where you stand on the death penalty is interesting, because they talk about it from the female's point of view and then the male's point of view, but they rationalize it in a certain way about the death penalty in itself. So it's just really well done. And the last thing I want to say, I know you have other points to make too, is that his brother's in it. And it's really amazing to see him, because at first when they first interviewed him, I didn't know where his head was at, and then to see it, and then as it goes along, and he's in it for very small parts of every, I think it's a five-part docuseries.
I believe so, yeah.
So he's, you know, he's kind of peppered in there within the five episodes, but it's almost, you kind of see his thought process of from beginning, he's my brother, to he's, a strange brother, to he's a murderer.
Right.
It's
and that last, I'm not gonna spoil it, but like when they show him that picture, what he says about the picture, like at the end, is so powerful. I think that really stuck in my head.
And I think the other part is, I mean, so I read a lot about him in the past. I read The Stranger Beside Me, the Anne Rule book. I read there was another it wasn't a book specifically to him, but there was a chapter about him and his and kind of just the last killings when he escaped and things like that. What I think blew me away was when they started showing the maps and then the victims and then the amount and then ones that are solved, ones that are unsolved, ones where they found bodies, ones where they didn't. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, I know he's a bad man, but I felt more evil watching. I don't even know. I feel like it's even worse. Like that they talk about all these other people, but this guy and what he did and how it affected the families and just how many.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think another part that really stuck out, going back to like the feminism thing, is the message at the time for women with like from men was like, oh, you know, if you get raped, like, don't fight back, just submit, and then like you won't get hurt, but if you fight back then you're gonna die, and like you'll be okay if you just like submit. And I think that really infuriated me
a
lot.
And the women that they interview outside of the victims and the victims' families, their stories are, they touch upon them, but it's just amazing because they talk about specific women entering the police force and what they had to deal with as well. And I think that comes down to your point about this self-defense and how it grew on campuses and things like that, right. And how people had to figure out how to just, I don't know, navigate this, mm-hmm. this thing, because it came, the best part about it was how they're showing, you know, women are standing up for themselves and now they're fighting for their rights. And then all of a sudden this dark cloud just surrounds them with these murders. And it's, and of course the movement's happening on campuses. And again, they're only talking in specific areas of the country. So that you see that, and you know, they were very progressive in the, or at least these campuses, I know a lot of campuses usually are, but mm-hmm. so how they're being very progressive. And then all of a sudden these killings are happening. So right. these two worlds collide and it's almost, you know, one step forward, 10 steps back. Mm. So,
So,
it's not, it's, I mean, you'll binge watch it. I don't see how you cannot, because it's going
to
keep
you, just
you,
need to
you
like,
want to
yeah.
see how it goes, but it makes you think. So if you have Amazon Prime, watch it. Oh, actually speaking of that, well, we'll get to it. Go ahead. But that's really,
okay.
that's, I can't recommend it more than I think we already
have. Yeah. It's amazing. I feel like I need to watch it again too, just to like let everything soak in again. But also we finally watched the end of The Good Place, which we've been waiting on for a while. We've just sort of, you know, been ignoring it. But it was kind of satisfying, I think.
No, I think they
did it well.
It's hard to end a series.
Hard to say goodbye.
And they did it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I know you guys are probably a lot more into it than I mean, I liked it, but I wasn't invested as much as you and your mom were, but I liked it.
I was very happy. And I don't know. I don't want to like say anything about like what happens, but I think that like it makes sense that they ended it where they did, and like I think it's good. Even though I wish that there would be more seasons, it's better than them like, you know, just like massacring the characters. And
well, it's one of those things where when you know you have something good and you can, I mean, I don't want to say they were on top, but to finish on a high note, it's mm-hmm. worth it. And you know, it's better than ending it with more controversy or people saying that sucked and that's the last thing you remember. So
right, that's true.
It's better go on a positive.
Yeah. So I mean, that was a little short like snippet of what
we haven't really talked about it throughout. So
yeah, it's kind of it was definitely good. And then you today watched.
I watched Togo with you because your brother's homesick and I've been wanting to watch this forever because you just don't want to watch it because you don't care about dogs.
No,
and
just isn't that my kind of movie.
Oh my god, it is. One of the best movies I have seen. I mean, it's Disney, so it's hard to like say that. Oh, you know, the Disney, you know, predictability and also the crap of like.
Well, it's a true story too.
It is, and it completely blows away the whole Balto, because Balto has a statue in the Central Park about what it did about saving these basically stories about. There's a diphtheria outbreak in Alaska. Nothing can fly in and out. It takes place in like 1925. And the only way to go through it is on a dog sled. And there's only this one person who can go that distance because the storm that's coming is insane. Almost to the schoolhouse blizzard kind of
which
thing.
I do want to say something about that in a second.
So all that's happening. And so he has to do it. And, the dog Togo is 12 years old and they're all like, his wife is like, the dog can't make it, but you know, he knows he's like, I can't make it without it. But the story's insane. And how it all happens. And then they show you how Balto became the face of this. Cause they, you know, in the end they save the children, but, mm-hmm. Balto in the newspaper cause he ends up doing the last leg, this other, dog sled owner, Gunnar Skassen, or I can't remember his name, but it tells nothing about the real story. And oh my god. And I know you're more of a cat person, I'm a dog person.
No, yeah. I like both. I don't.
It is so emotional. It is so well done. Willem Dafoe's in it. And I know it's Disney, but I'm telling you, just you need like a box of tissues because it is insane. And the way they do it, the story of the how they do the flashbacks and the story of Togo, the dog himself. Oh my god. And I just found out that there's a whole specific type of husky called a Sepala Siberian that's based on the owner's name was Sepala. And they were just renowned for their loyalty, they were super smart, training, everything else. So yeah, I know, probably longer than you wanted to hear, because I know you didn't see it, but oh my God, it's so good. And I'm glad I finally saw it. And when your mom sees it, I'm going to have two boxes of tissues.
Okay. Well, you just reminded me with you bringing up the Schoolhouse Blizzard. Our second semester has started, and for one of my classes, I'm doing a graduation project. And for that, I'm writing a full-length movie script. And I just like solidified what the plot is. And it's a lot of it is like inspiration from this podcast. So there's a couple elements from your Schoolhouse Blizzard story. There's a couple elements from my Smee story. There's a little bit of Agatha Christie in there. There's a little bit of The Shining in there. So I don't know. I'm very excited about that. And you just reminded me to talk about it because the Schoolhouse Blizzard. But I mean, I could chat your like ears off about it, but I won't because we actually have stories that we need to be telling you. But yeah, definitely excited for that. And I guess, I don't know, I'll update you as we continue on.
I'm looking forward to it. I think it's gonna be cool.
Yes, hopefully. And then the newest episode of Doctor Who we watched. I liked it. We watched it separate this time because you and Mom were a little bit sick. So you didn't want to contaminate our good friends, the Sabatinos. So my brother and I just went over to their house and we were pretty much like live texting about it. I thought it was good. Mom didn't like it.
I don't know how to say it. I mean, it wasn't bad, and I'm not trying to say it wasn't good. I think the problem is that I don't think they give enough time to the Doctor.
Because there's too many companions, you were saying.
It's called Doctor Who. And I think that it does a disservice to Jodie Whittaker as the Doc. So I would like to see more.
That's very true.
Of her.
She does just kind of like pop in every now and again.
Yeah, and I mean, and she does it well, but I just think that she still, to me, like, I feel like they're making her more clown-like. Where, you know, with Matt Smith, when he did his thing and, like, he was kind of, you know, aloof and everything, it was different. You know what I mean?
He had, like, darker moments, I feel like.
Well, and maybe, again, you know, I know it's relatively early, but again, it is the second season. I just wish that they would focus more on her. And I know we know about the Doctor, but we don't know about this Doctor. So let's learn more about this Doctor.
Yes.
And maybe they're setting that up for the two-part end of the year thing, end of season thing.
And yeah.
But I think for folks who haven't watched it, and if you aren't, maybe if you care about current events, the only downside is that they're pretty heavy-handed on, you guys are screwing up the Earth.
Well, I think that they have to be, honestly. I feel like it's good that they're
I just think that this audience who watch this show are already on that side. So I feel like you're just making it like, okay, duh, we get it. Let's be a little bit smarter about it. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. I think for me, I think the best few episodes of this season so far have been the ones that are not just Chris Chibnall writing.
Yeah.
And I feel like I don't really like his writing.
Yeah. Well, I feel like it's hard for him. I mean, he's following
really big footsteps.
Yeah. And, he's got to make it his own way. So it, like I said, it's not a bad season. I still want to see it. I am concerned though, that if it stays like this, the way it ends the season, they won't get canceled. I just think they're going to lose a lot of audience. And then there may be another Doctor, which is not fair. And I don't want another Doctor. I want Whittaker to have the same moments that Tennant and Smith and Capaldi had, where you're like, yeah, you know, but yeah. So, and I'm looking forward to next week's because it looks good, spooky.
Oh yes,
ghost story,
boogeyman, very spooky with like the. Yeah. Okay, and then I'll hand it over to you.
Well, the one thing I want to say before I get to that is, I said that thing about Amazon Prime, the show that Most Haunted. And we're saying, remember, we wanted to watch that episode that you were talking about? And then we tried to. We found out that
it wasn't on Amazon.
Season Prime. 5 is not on Prime. Seasons 1 through 4 are, but season 5 is not. Yeah. And then I think season 6 and further are on Prime.
Wow, so, they really just wanted to
screw us over. So I apologize that we led you astray if you wanted to learn more about the RAM, the, what's it called?
Ancient Ramen.
Ancient Ramen.
Which I think that would have been a really fun episode to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that might become.
We'll find it somewhere else.
It might become. It may be, maybe I'll get on Prime soon. And then for Liverpool, we won again. Yes. So we beat Southampton, and it was a tough game again. The first half was crazy, but we won 4-0. And the score, even though it was 4-0, the game was a lot closer than that. And Southampton could have won that game easily. But that's 25 games into the season. There's 13 left. We could have had a total of 75 points. We have 73 out of 75. City lost on Sunday. So we are now 22 points in the lead. We need 7 wins in our next 13 games, and we are champions. And depending on how City goes, City has some tough games coming. They got to still play United again. They got to play Chelsea. We've played all these guys. Well, we've played most of them. And if they drop points, we could win the title. And they're, and this is bad, but and I don't want to jinx it. I'm knocking on wood. but we could win the title at Everton, which I don't know. I don't know. But it is something. So we're on break now, but there is a FA Cup game tomorrow, and Klopp's playing the kids. The under-23s are playing the cup because the seniors are on break. So we'll see how that goes. But the train's rolling on, and the momentum's there. I say it every week. It is a crazy, magical, spectacular season. And if you are not if you haven't picked your team yet, this is the time. The Reds, go! It's something to watch. But so you're doing
true crime.
All right, I got a paranormal.
Ooh, I'm excited.
All right, well, let's hear it.
So something interesting about my story this week is that I was just listening to, and that's why we drink. And their listener stories, like they publish it on the first of every month, right? So I was listening to that. The February one, and it's February 3rd right now, and I wrote this story January something, like the day our last episode came out. And as I was listening to the listener stories, one of the submissions was from someone who worked sort of like very close to the case that I'm covering today. And so they kind of gave like a brief summary on And That's Why We Drink, and they hadn't heard of it. So I think you probably have heard of it because it's got a connection to Bruce Springsteen. But anyway,
all right.
So I just thought that was kind of funky that it came up.
I'm racking my brain right now about true crime and things that I would have had
When I get to the first line of my story, hopefully you'll get it. We'll pause in a second just so I can figure it out if you get it. Okay, so my sources, first of all, are Plains Humanities, two different Wikipedia pages, which I won't say the titles of yet.
Okay.
History.com, biography.com, YO History, as in Wyoming History, Omaha.com.
I know what it is.
And Murderpedia.
I know exactly what it is. I do know what it is. I know what your song is. I know everything about it. All right, for it.
Well, it wasn't my first line then.
Well, actually, no, this can't be true because the people would know this story. And there's no. I'm thinking something else. Keep
what do you think?
No, just go.
Okay.
I'm thinking. Oh yeah, go ahead.
Okay, Charles Starkweather was born on November 24th, 1938, in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Yeah, I know what it is. You're telling me that And That's Why We Drink don't know this story?
They did not know it.
Come on.
They didn't know it.
So is your song going to be...
It's Nebraska.
It's going to be Nebraska.
Because
not Badlands.
No, because Nebraska is literally based off the story.
I know this. I understand, but I just didn't know if you were
gonna... I was debating, but I think that we could attribute Badlands to other stories, okay. Too.
Yeah, sorry.
So I'm using Nebraska.
Nebraska is one of the best albums ever by Springsteen. It's one of my favorite albums. We've actually used songs from... from Nebraska in the past, but this is great.
I'm using the live one too. I think I want to use the live one.
The
Meadowlands.
Okay, cool. Yeah, it's worth it.
Okay. Anyway,
people should listen to the whole album of Nebraska after this too. So
just. Yeah, I mean I really like that album. So okay, so you know this.
Yes. Well, I don't know every detail. I know the story. Not by the song, but I remember reading about it in, I probably read about it in high school.
Interesting. Well, I kind of think I'd heard of his name, but I didn't know the story until I researched it.
Okay.
I
still can't believe they don't know that. Oh, wow.
And I found it because I got I get this day in history emails.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was in that, and then it said like featured on Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska, and I was like, oh, I have my story. So Charles Starkweather was born on November 24th, Lincoln, Nebraska, 1938. Great. He was the third of seven children.
I'm listening. Like the song is playing in the back of my head right now as you do this. Like, go ahead.
Well, is it going to be playing for the next like 25 minutes?
I'm fine with that. It's a great song.
So he was the third of seven children to Guy and Helen Starkweather. The family was pretty working class. Guy worked as a carpenter, but was often unemployed due to suffering rheumatoid arthritis. And then to support the family, Helen worked as a waitress. And Starkweather's family life was pretty positive. There's no like records of abuse, and by all accounts, his parents seemed like loving, caring protectors of him and his siblings. So seemed pretty like a good upbringing. However, the environment at Charles's school was completely different. Due to a mild birth defect, Charles's legs were misshapen, and he also spoke with a speech impediment. And these qualities led to him being teased mercilessly by his peers, which is unfortunate. And so as he grew, Charles became stronger and stronger, and he started to excel at gym. And that was, in fact, the only class that he excelled in. And he would use that class like as a physical outlet for his rage against his bullies. And eventually he became strong enough to now bully his bullies.
Okay, yeah.
So, that sort of strength soon turned into rage against just anyone he disliked, and he quickly became pretty feared in his school and in the community. He was previously known as one of the most well-behaved teenagers in his community. One might even call him a pillar of the community. I did write that into my notes. I saw your face like light up. So Charles was now known as the most troubled. He became fascinated by guns and hunting, and he saw himself as like a James Dean kind of like rebel without a cause type character. He like wore the leather jacket and like all that. In fact, he was described as, quote, a swaggering, good-for-nothing in blue jeans and a black motorcycle jacket. So one of his friends, his childhood friends, Bob von Busch, there's a C in there, so I don't know if it's Bush or something. Anyway, so he recalled about Charles, quote, he could be the kindest person you've ever seen. He'd do anything for you if he liked you. He was a hell of a lot of fun to be around, too. Everything was just one big joke to him. But he had this other side. He could be mean as hell, cruel. If he saw some poor guy on the street who was bigger than he was, better looking, or better dressed, he'd try to take the poor bastard down to his size.
Slight insecurity there.
Little bit. So, in 1956, when he was 18, Charles was introduced to 13-year-old Carol Ann Fugate.
Mm-hmm.
And she was born on July 30th, 1943. And so she was the younger sister of his ex-girlfriend. And another source said that...
I didn't know that.
Well, another source said that she was the younger sister of his friend's ex-girlfriend. And then, like... Well,
not sure if it makes it... Either one makes it better, but I guess if it's your ex-girlfriend's younger sister,
yeah,
that's kind of...
That's...
Yeah.
Really, I mean,
but I mean, she's 13, so it's still
it's
like...
It's gross no matter what.
Yeah.
So by this time, while he's 18, he dropped out of high school and was working at a newspaper warehouse. He was known to be a poor worker. According to his boss, quote, sometimes you'd have to tell him something two or three times. Of all the employees in the warehouse, he was the dumbest man we had.
Hmm.
So, again, he only excelled at gym in high school and in school in general.
Well, again, maybe yeah, it's just a level of interest. So.
Yeah, that's true. And so the reason that he was working at that newspaper warehouse was because it was located near Carol's school.
Oh, God.
Whittier Junior High School.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started visiting Carol every day after school, and then they just quickly started dating.
Okay, again, disgusting.
Yeah.
But did she, I can't remember, I can't remember pictures because I'm trying to remember if she looked older than she was.
I looked up some pictures of her and she looks pretty young.
Okay.
She's tiny. She's so short.
Yeah.
She does not look older than she was. Absolutely not. All right. She looks, in fact, younger. She looks, I don't know. But yeah, she definitely does not look older than 13.
Mm-hmm.
So Charles taught Carol how to drive. And one day while they were out, she crashed his 1949 Ford into another car, damaging it. I think probably both cars. And the registered owner of the vehicle was Charles's father, who did pay to get it fixed, but he was furious.
Understandable.
Because Carol was unlicensed,
right.
First of all.
Right.
And he was just, like, pissed off at Charles's, like, careless behavior. So refusing to condone him, Guy kicked Charles out.
Okay.
So, Charles then quit his job at the warehouse and became a garbage collector. He started thinking that his life would never improve and that it could only get worse for him. He would spend his garbage routes dreaming up ideas for bank robberies, and at this time he came up with like this personal philosophy. And it was, quote, dead people are all on the same level.
Oh my God. Is that actually a philosophy? Yeah, or is that a manifesto?
Wait, yeah, right. Honestly.
I guess that's the same thing, right? Your manifesto is your philosophy. Yeah. So fair enough.
During this time, he would also suffer violent, terrifying nightmares and vivid hallucinations where he would converse with death. So that's not concerning at all.
Oh my.
He was known for yelling, "Go to hell," to strangers, I think, while he was on his route. And at this point, he had died. He had red hair.
So at this point, he's no longer the pillar of the community.
Oh, no, he's way past
okay,
that.
Okay, I just wanted to. So at some point, he lost the title. Toppled, right, he lost the title. Okay.
So he had red hair, but he dyed it black with shoe polish at this point. And he was about 5'5". So.
Okay.
He was only an inch taller than me.
So 5'5", and you're saying that Carol was tiny too.
The picture that I saw of her, she was sitting next to like a cop, and I don't know how tall he was.
All right, fair enough.
I thought she looked really tiny in the picture.
Okay.
So, I mean, he could have been like 7 feet tall. I would not know. But I saved a couple pictures that I can show you. That'll be posted on our Instagram too. So, during the night of November 30th, 1957, some sources say it was December 1st, Charles attempted to buy a stuffed animal from a service station in Lincoln using credit. And the clerk, Robert Colvert, who's 21, refused to sell it to him because most purchases were supposed to be like made in cash or something, and I don't know. So this angered Charles, and he left. But then multiple times throughout the night, he like returned to buy other items. I'm assuming with cash, or maybe he was just buying the ones that you were supposed to buy with credit.
I don't really know. Okay.
Finally, like for the last time, he visited and brandished a shotgun at Colvert, forcing him to give him $100 from the register.
Mm-hmm.
He then drove Colvert to a remote area where the pair struggled for the gun. Colvert was injured, and then Charles regained possession of the gun and shot him in the head.
Oh, I didn't know there was a struggle.
Yeah, there was.
Okay.
Which, I mean, glad that he fought back.
Well, I just, the way I remember the story, I thought it was just that I was, you know, and just cold-blooded, because this is different. This is, I'm not saying he's still.
I think he was trying to kill him.
Oh, okay.
But I think that like there was a struggle because like he was able to like somehow gain the upper hand.
I thought he was gonna like just knock him out. Well, I guess if he's
seen his face,
right?
And,
right. So he's can't keep him alive. Okay.
Right.
So I take all that back.
So, after this first murder, Charles believed that he had, quote, transcended his former self.
Oh my God.
In his new plane of existence, he was outside the law and could commit any crime without guilt or fear of repercussion.
So all this that you're reading from wherever sources, that, I mean, somebody had to have these conversations with him.
Yeah.
And
I think this was like after, spoiler alert, he was caught.
Right. But what I'm trying to understand is that he wasn't the brightest bulb. So I feel like they're making
him out. Could have been like a psychiatrist evaluation.
No, I understand, but I feel like they're also making him out to be this like mastermind.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I have this, when you talk about the philosophy and or the, you know, or when I was his manifesto or whatever, I feel that there's this delusions of grandeur and that we should be thinking about it in that way versus this guy who is like, I have the way.
Yeah, I think him seeing himself as like this James Dean character is a lot of like what his like justification was.
Yeah.
Like how he's like outside the law, like, oh, I'm so cool.
It's always the movie's fault. They just
video games.
Satanic. All of them.
Yeah. So on January 21st, 1958, Charles visited Carol's home to retrieve her. Her mother and stepfather, Velda and Marion Bartlett, he's 57 and I don't know how old the mother was, warned Charles to stay away. Then in response, Charles fatally shot them. And
okay,
then,
well, just get rid of, that's easy way to get rid of all those problems.
Yeah, clearly.
Obstacle, no worries.
And then strangled and stabbed to death their 2-year-old daughter, Betty Jean.
Uh-huh. And Carol's just like...
I'll get there in a second.
Mm-hmm.
So he hid the 3 bodies behind the house.
So she has no idea.
Well, later, Charles claimed that Carol was there the entire time. But then she said that she had arrived home after the murders to see Charles with a gun pointed at her. And she said that he told her that her family was being held hostage and he'd let them go if she cooperated with him. And if not, he would kill them.
Again, I don't know the whole story, but I'm thinking she's 13.
Yeah.
Now we're saying that Jesus, not we, or whatever, whoever is listening to his story.
Some
calculating mastermind herself,
right,
of let's just kill my family so we can go on the run because you are my knight in shining armor.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, there are like some child killers like Mary Bell, who's like just like, I don't know, psychopathic or sociopathic. But I feel like Carol Ann's upbringing like that I could read wasn't anything crazy. Personally, I think she's innocent, but we'll get into that.
Okay.
So, the couple remained in the house for a few days, leaving just before police arrived on January 27th. So that's 6 days after the killings. Allegedly, Carol told curious neighbors that her family was bedridden with the flu, and then Carol's grandmother, who was suspicious of the story, had called the police to check in.
Okay.
So, they leave just before the police get there, and they drive to the farmhouse of Carol's family friend, 70-year-old August Meyer, in Bennett, Nebraska.
Yep.
So, Charles shot him in the head with a shotgun, killing him, and he also killed Meyer's dog, because, you know.
And now Carol's witnessing this.
Yes, yeah. And... I don't really know why they drove to the farmhouse because they like immediately fled afterwards. So, I mean,
well, maybe.
Maybe
she
they
freaked
were,
out. I don't know.
Maybe they were going to use it like for to stay in, but then like there was a disagreement or something. I don't know exactly what happened there.
Maybe the sound of a shotgun going off.
That's true.
So
that's very
who knows?
True. So then they fled and they drove the car. I believe it was, I can't remember whose car it was. Somebody's car. Like either Carol's family's or Charles's.
Yep.
They drove it into the mud and abandoned it.
Okay.
So then they started hitchhiking. And along the way, local teenagers Robert Jensen, 17, and Carol King, 16, stopped to give them a ride.
Mm-hmm.
Charles forced them to drive to an abandoned storm cellar and then brought them inside. There he shot Jensen in the back of the head. And then he attempted to rape Carol King.
I didn't know that.
But he wasn't able to. So instead, he just shot her in anger.
All right.
So later, he claimed that he'd shot Jensen, but Carol shot King.
Okay.
And then she claimed that she was just in the car the whole time.
Okay.
So then the two fled using Jensen's car. They drove to the wealthy section of Lincoln, Nebraska, where they entered the home of C. Lauer Ward, 47, and his wife, Clara, 46. So Ward was, like, really wealthy. He was an industrialist. And so they, again, they lived in the wealthy section of Lincoln. So they likely are wealthy. So they break into the house and they're met by the ward's maid, Lillian Finchie, who is 51. And then Charles stabbed her to death.
Huh.
Yeah. Then Charles killed their dog to keep it from alerting the family when they returned. Oh, man. So Clara came home first and was stabbed to death. Charles claimed that he threw a knife at her, but the one who actually stabbed her to death was Carol. And again, Carol was like, no, I did not do any of this. So whatever happened, Clara was stabbed to death. Then Clara's husband eventually returned, and Charles shot and killed him. The pair then stole jewelry from the house and drove out of Nebraska in the Ward's black 1956 Packard.
Okay.
Which is apparently like a luxury car.
All right.
Brain. So because the Wards were so rich, their murder caused great uproar in the county.
Right.
Because, you know, that's how it goes.
Well, of course, you know. Yeah. Only the rich can't. Now we have to solve the problem.
That's right. Like, are worth more anyways.
Right,
so.
Right.
Yeah, so police amassed to search the town house by house. They were, like, going door to door. The Nebraska National Guard was summoned. And they figured out that Charles and Carol were the perpetrators pretty quickly. I think probably because
of a string of bodies they had left.
And also, like, they had left their car in the mud by, like, Meyer's house. Right. And, like, there was just, like, this huge trail. And Charles wasn't that careful anyway. So, like, there was probably a lot of evidence that pointed to them.
Right.
And also them finding Carol's whole family murdered and her missing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
knowing that they were, like, pretty obvious. So sightings of the pair were reported throughout the state, but no arrests were made, which led the public to accuse the police of incompetence.
Rich public, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
And also Charles and Carol were out of Nebraska at this point.
Okay.
So they needed a new car because the Packard had been identified as being the Ward's. So they were like, okay, gotta leave the life of luxury behind. So while they were driving on the highway near Douglas, Wyoming, they came upon traveling salesman Merle Collison, 37, sleeping in his Buick. Charles broke into the car, which woke up Merle, and quickly shot him, I believe, in the head.
Okay.
He claimed that he injured him because his shotgun jammed, and then Carol was the one who actually killed him.
All right, fine.
Which I feel like he keeps doing that a lot.
Yeah.
And again, Carol denied ever killing anyone, but he described her as, quote, the most trigger-happy person he'd ever met.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I could see if this whole Patty Hearst syndrome thing happens and, you know, all of a sudden you're fearing for your life and then all of a sudden, you know, you're 13, so...
Right. I think by this point she's 14, but still, like...
For all you know, something triggers where there's, like, this bloodlust, and it doesn't mean she... Or it could
be, like, she's so afraid of him that she's like, I have to do what he says. Like,
yeah.
If he's like, now you have to go stab
It's a child, person. So you can manipulate him, but he seems to be a child as well, but whatever. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
So, what Charles didn't know is that Merle's car had a parking brake. Okay. I don't know what that means. I'm not, you know, old.
cars today have parking brakes as well, so go ahead.
Never mind. I was thinking the thingy.
That just because it's not the thingy doesn't mean that cars still don't have a parking brake.
Anyway, right. Charles didn't know how to operate it.
Okay. Well.
Listen, I'm not intending on going on a murder spree, so I don't have to worry about this. All right. So anyway, the car stalled when he tried to drive away.
Okay.
So then he attempted to restart the engine. And a passing motorist stopped by to help him because, mm-hmm. you know, he's a good person. Charles immediately threatened him with a rifle because when someone stops to help you, so the two sort of like had an altercation. And luckily, at that moment, or maybe someone noticed it and called the deputy sheriff, but a deputy sheriff arrived at the scene. And while this like altercation is going on with Charles and the motorist person, Carol gets out of the car and runs to the deputy sheriff, shouting something along the lines of, it's dark weather, he's going to kill me, something like that.
Okay.
So she's now in safety with the deputy sheriff. And Charles manages to get the car working, and just speeds off at 100 miles per hour.
Okay.
The sheriff shot at the car, and one of the bullets shattered the window and sent glass shards like flying into the car. One of them hit Charles and cut him deeply enough to cause bleeding. And he started thinking that he was bleeding to death. So he pulled over and stopped the car and was apprehended.
Okay.
And there was a quote from like some deputy or something. I didn't copy it in here, but he was like, oh, he was such a coward, this guy. Like, he just thought he was bleeding to death, which is why he gave himself up.
So that's just an odd statement in itself, it was but kind whatever. Of weird. All right.
And so Charles chose to be extradited from Wyoming to Nebraska, figuring that he'd get the death penalty either way because it was legal in both states.
Yeah.
Fun fact, though, at the time, Wyoming's governor actually opposed the death penalty. So if he had chosen to be tried in Wyoming, he probably wouldn't have been at risk of it.
Okay. So
good job there, buddy.
But he would have been tried either on both anyway. I mean, just because he would have been tried in Wyoming.
He was only tried in Nebraska instead of... Like, he wasn't
trying. Well, once you get the death penalty, you don't. It's not going to matter. So, had he done Wyoming, got convicted, and was sentenced to life, they'd still try him in Nebraska for the others. So, it wouldn't have mattered.
Okay, well, at first, Charles claimed...
Where were the rich people? Where did they live? In Nebraska?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it would have been Nebraska anyway. So,
at first, Charles claimed that Carol had been his kidnapping victim, and she'd done nothing wrong. Like, he actually was like, leave the girl alone. She did nothing wrong, whatever. And then later he changed his story, which he actually changed his story several times.
Right.
And he claimed that she was a willing participant. Carol never wavered from her story of being kidnapped, but Judge Harry A. Spencer believed that she was an accomplice. In his opinion, she had plenty of opportunities to escape. Like, he left you in the car alone. Like, you could have just gone. No, I'm sorry, but no. Like, there's just so many reasons. Like, the fear alone.
Well, again, to bring it back to the beginning, our opening, that the same thing in that.
And she could have thought that he still, like, her. She could have thought her family was still alive.
But it's not even that. Remember the opening when we watched on that documentary, the Ted Bundy documentary, that first victim that no one knew about, and she just said, people don't understand victims. They get judged. They, you know, you don't understand their how they're thinking and all these other things. And I think that's the other point that is very that needs to be made is that you can't be in those shoes unless you are. You don't know how people are reacting.
Right.
What the will to survive
Everyone
is.
Everyone reacts differently.
So you're right. So the judge to say those things is terrible because.
But again, it is like the 50s. So
fair enough. Not but it still happens today. Like, I mean, anyone you're who right. accuses anybody you're of right. anything, it's right immediately you're vilified. So you can't win anyway. But go ahead.
Right. So Charles was convicted for the murder of Robert Jensen, which was the only murder that he was tried for, which is interesting. You'd think that
and
the
that's
rich
the
people...
farmhouse guy, right?
No, that's the teenager, Robert Jensen and Carol King.
Wait, they didn't convict him on the rich people?
They didn't.
What?
I know. They only tried him for the teenager.
Well, he got the death penalty and they're done.
Yeah, I mean, they're like, right, it's not even worth it.
So they're like, okay.
Yeah, so... As he was taken to Nebraska State Penitentiary, he said that he, quote, believed that he was supposed to die, but if he was to be executed, then Carol should be also. Nice, buddy.
It's in the song.
Yeah, I know. he also told the sheriff, quote, I always wanted to be a criminal, but not this big a one.
Oh, God.
Great, great, Charles. Charles Starkweather was executed by electric chair at 12:04 a.m. on June 25th, 1959. And he is buried in the same cemetery as five of his victims.
Oh.
I know. Carol, on the other hand, was convicted of being an accomplice and given a life sentence on November 21st, 1958. She was paroled after 17 and a half years serving at the Nebraska Correctional Center for Women. She then moved to Michigan and changed her name. She got a job as a janitor at a hospital. And then in 2007, she got married. And then in 2013, she and her husband got into a horrific car accident. And she was only injured, but he was killed, unfortunately. And this is what that story was about, and that's why we drink. The person was like the person who did the autopsy on the husband's body, because since she was an ex serial killer, they were like, oh, what if she killed him and stuff, and so
she got when she was paroled, she was like 32, 33.
Yeah, around that.
And then when did she marry? You said 2007. So how old was she then?
Don't make
me. Wait, when, what was her birth? You said it was her, right?
Oh, so she was 43 was her birthday.
So she was 60-something when she got married. Wow. Wow.
I mean, you've just been released from prison. Like,
no, but she was released from prison 17 years after.
Yeah, 64.
Right. So she was released at like age 30-something.
Yeah, but you know.
That was 30 years later she got married. Whatever. Okay. I didn't know about the death and that kind of thing.
So she wasn't like implicated or anything in that. Like his death. It was an accident. But she's refused to speak about the murder since her release, except like once in 1996, she spoke in a radio interview.
Mm-hmm.
But besides that, she's been silent. And according to a 2014 article, Carol asked for a state pardon in 1996, and again in 2014, but I don't know if she got it. I don't think she did.
Hmm.
In all, Charles and possibly Carol killed 11 people and 2 dogs. I don't think that she did it personally.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I think that if it comes down to her original family, so if mm-hmm. they can't figure or they don't have evidence or believe that there was any animosity, because I think that's where it would have started. It would have to have been planned
and
from
then. And it takes, like, to kill your 2-year-old sister, that's... Again, like,
I think if there's nothing around there, then...
And I feel like they would have mentioned that.
Yeah, in the articles. I think so. I think so, too.
So, numerous movies have been made about and inspired by Charles Starkweather's story, including The Sadist, 1963, Badlands, 1973, California with a K, 1993, Natural Born Killers, 1994, and Starkweather, 2004. There's also a lot of books about the case. Stephen King said that he was strongly influenced by the murders when he was younger, and he kept a scrapbook of articles about them.
Mm-hmm.
Liza Ward, the granddaughter of the Wards, used the murders of her grandparents as inspiration for her book Outside Valentine, in 2004. And then lastly, as we talked about in the opening, or the beginning of my story, Bruce Springsteen's song Nebraska, and like the album is kind of
he decided to write the album after reading about that, and he just, and I'm not sure what happened or what period of time, because I think Nebraska is in post Born to Run, so I think it's...
Well, it was released in 1982.
Yeah, okay, so there must have been a movie that, or something that was written about it that happened to go through it, because, I mean, he would have been alive when it happened. I mean, he would have read about it when he was growing up.
The movie Badlands came out in 1973.
Yeah, so I don't know. That I mean, I know he read about it, and he inspired him to write the album.
Hmm. Wow. So, yeah. Yeah, that is the story of
Charles. Yeah, I didn't know all the details. For some reason, I didn't think it was that many that he had killed either. Mm-hmm. I thought it was only 3 or 4.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Yeah, that was good. No, good. And if it gets people listening to Nebraska, even better.
Honestly, yeah. I was like, the second I saw that, I was like, sold.
Cool.
But yeah, that's my story.
Awesome. Well done. All right. I'm doing paranormal.
I'm excited.
I'm just going to go right into the overview before I talk about anything else, because if I go through my overall background and detail, you'll know what this is.
Okay.
Right. June 4th, 1982, the following was witnessed. The Freeling family had moved into a new home and seemed to be living the American dream. Within weeks, a few weeks, I would say.
Oh, boy.
Unexplained occurrences started to happen. At first, it was only in the kitchen, focusing there.
No, not the kitchen. That's where the food is.
Right. Plates would move, cups would fall, things like that. And it mainly occurred around the daughter. Okay.
Interesting.
And she was the youngest of three children.
That's so weird. That's a lot like Pontefract. It focused on the daughter and she was like
really Well, actually, young. I'll talk about something about that in parapsychology. They always believe it's
I feel it's like it's the daughter centered around like a young daughter girl
hitting puberty. It's yeah, always around puberty.
Yeah, I think I think so, you've mentioned like that before. Witches,
yeah. Because of the witching, you know. her parents, she had an older sister and an middle brother, older brother, believed it was just her way of coping with this move, you know, uprooting from her previous friends and family. Her dad had a pretty stressful job. I believe he worked for, I don't know if it was space or airplanes or something like that, but building large flying objects. So he worked also pretty late a lot. A couple of times after these weird things were happening, they just found her wandering the house. Mm. Okay. And they chalked it up to she's sleepwalking. Again, the stress. Like, there's just things going on. However, one night, her brother would experience his own manifestation.
Oh, boy.
And this one turned it from plates flying and things like that to more physical and more violent.
Oh, no.
He had just gone to bed. And as he was laying his head on the pillow, his eyelids were becoming heavy.
Oh, no.
And he was fighting to keep them open. You know, it's the end night. But for some reason, as much as he was fighting to keep them open, he wanted to keep them open. He started to scan the room. I mean, which we all do when we're trying to go to sleep at night. You kind of just take a look around the room. Is there something there? The closet, oh, that kind of thing. And he notices something across him, across from the foot of the bed.
No.
Yes.
Why are they always at the foot of the bed?
I don't know. Across the foot of the bed or, you know, by there, he's got a chair and he sees one of his toys facing him.
No.
He knew something was off because moments earlier he had placed his pajamas there when he was changing him into his pajamas and there was nothing on the chair.
Oh my God.
In his head, he's trying to remember, wait, did I put it back up? Did I remember changing this, that, whatever. Well, he just thought, whatever, I'm going back to bed. It's time to go. So he closes his eyes to go to sleep. Again, something in his subconscious makes him open his eyes again.
Please don't tell me it's moved.
When he focuses on the chair, the toy's gone.
Oh!
This causes him to jump up in bed. Like, I mean, literally sit up in bed.
Ew, I would literally duck under my covers.
Well, he slowly scans the room again to see where this toy could be. And it's nowhere to be found.
No.
He then decides to check.
Under the bed.
He leans over and he slowly peers
No.
Goes under there, lifts up. Is it like the little like ruffle?
Yeah.
Lifts up the ruffle. Head goes down. Nothing. He sits back up, ready to go scan the room again.
It's there.
And he turns around, and there's his toy.
Like, next to him?
Behind him.
Ah!
And his toy?
Is a clown.
A clown.
This is Poltergeist.
This is a scene from Spielberg's 82 film Poltergeist, released on June 4th, 1982. And the reason I'm describing this scene is that this is what most 80s kids who were allowed to watch these kind of movies, that's their fear. Beginning and fear of clowns.
That's yours, right?
It is.
Is that what made you fear clowns?
Pretty much. But this movie was inspired by a true story.
I think I knew that.
Do you know the story?
I don't know if I do. But speaking of clowns, today I was doing some research for my graduation project. Like, I was trying to figure out like what city it's taking place in.
It's your senior project. It's not your graduation project. But
it's the same thing.
Well, no.
They call it grad projects.
It's your grad. Yeah, but it's like a grad project. A graduate project. Call it that because it means more because it doesn't mean you can't graduate without it.
Okay. Anyway. Well, if I fail this class, then technically
I think you have enough credits already, but whatever.
Anyway, I was doing some research and I was looking at this one city and its claim to fame was its clown doll museum. And I took a look. It is terrifying. The whole thing is
I feel
just,
like we saw this.
It's in...
I mean, we didn't see it physically, but I think...
I think it's in Nebraska, so...
It must have been on some show. I feel like we've seen something like this, and we were all like, let's go on when we were doing your college tour. Like, hey, is your college around this place?
Yeah, it's in Plainview, Nebraska. It's terrifying. Literally, okay, I'm sorry to distract from your story, but I feel like I need to show you a picture of this. Are you ready?
See, the thing about that
there's too many?
Yeah, it's like it needs to be less because it's just less. You can't focus on anyone.
Okay,
it's like,
that's,
you know,
fair, but I feel like still I'm not a fan.
Well, again.
Okay, what about this though? Hold on. I'm sorry. I completely distracted from your story, but you reminded me. What if it was like just that?
That's bad.
That's definitely terrifying. Yeah. I'm going to put this picture on our Instagram. Let me send this to myself. So that we have it, so you can all experience this lovely emotion called fear. Okay, sorry, continue.
Well, no, so it's based, that whole scene, or the whole movie is actually based on a true story. And the true story is the Herman family. And it was a 1958 haunting by a poltergeist that they aptly named Popper.
Wait, I think I might know this, because I think I know the name Popper.
Popper the Poltergeist? Yeah. Well, there's a bunch of things about it. So, I mean, I think it's the first reality TV streamed haunting show, or whatever, like that. They actually brought cameras in for it, so it's the first thing to ever be on live television.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have to interrupt you again, because I found another one. Are you ready?
Sure. That actually... I feel like that clown is famous. Yeah, that's not
scary to you?
No, because like they're killing each other. So,
well, what happens after they're done killing each other?
I think they just go to the other clowns. I mean, if they have that many clowns, they're going to kill them all.
Okay, fine. All right.
So my sources were, again, the AmericanHauntingsInc.com. They actually... I'm not sure if they were first. I should have looked at the dates because a couple of the other ones were very, very similar. But there was a site called ParanormallyCorrect.com, and then Long Island Pulse, because this actually takes place on Long Island, wrote something years afterwards. And then Wikipedia, I just used it for the poltergeist because I was trying to figure out when it was released and everything else and that kind of thing. But we'll go right into the story. So,
all right.
At 1648 Redwood Path in Seaford, New York, it's a suburb of Long Island, lived the Herman family.
Okay.
And this is, so James was married to Lucille, and they had two kids, aptly named Lucille and James. But we're going to call them Lucy and Jimmy.
Yeah, I think M covered this because I remember the confusion over the names.
I was like, you got to be kidding me. So they basically, the way they moved into this place, and this is kind of similar to what was in Poltergeist, it was one of those cookie cutter neighborhoods where every house looked almost exactly the same, except the color was slightly different. They were a single floor or single story ranch, and three bedrooms, bathroom, dining room, living room, and the basement was split. So one was the utility area, one was the playroom. Lucille was a registered nurse, but the way she did her schedule, she actually could get home before the kids came back from school. Hmm. And James worked for Air France in New York City. So I think the character, Craig Nelson is the character in Poltergeist, him working for like an aerospace company is similar to this.
Yeah, it's been a while, but I think I remember.
But it was, you know, your post-nuclear family neighborhood, you know, 2.2 kids. Actually, they didn't have the dog, so. But this all happens within 5 years of them living in this place. So they've become used to it.
Right.
They're happy. They're living the American dream. And on February 3rd, 1958.
That's today.
Their dreams became a nightmare.
Yikes.
It was a regular school day, and Lucille was home waiting for the children, as I'd said before. And she's basically getting ready for dinner, prepping stuff, figuring out. I think she's like looking through the pantry and things like that. It's about 3:30 when the kids come home through the front door.
Oh boy.
And all of a sudden, and I don't, I mean, the way I read it or the way they make it is that they kind of came in the door, put their stuff away, and then they just heard these popping sounds coming from throughout the house. And I couldn't tell if they were, it meant that they all sound at all the same time or if it was like, you know, just kind of coming from room to room.
I was imagining like popcorn, like it's like very like one after the other.
Yeah. They didn't say how, if it was again concurrent or not, but it alarmed them and they start to inspect the house. And as they went from room to room, they found bottles tipped over, missing their caps.
Oh yeah, I remember this.
And the contents from the bottles had spilled out. And in the basement, it was a bottle of bleach. And that was, I think, the first thing they saw.
Oh, that's so wasteful.
Then in the kitchen, there was a bottle of liquid starch. In the bathroom, it was a bottle of shampoo. But in their master bedroom, it was a bottle of holy water.
Oh, I was imagining like a Coca-Cola bottle.
And what was this is what was kind of interesting too, is that all the bottles had screw caps.
Ooh.
And they were either metal or plastic. None of them were cork, so it wasn't like pressure, you know, popping the thing open, right. That kind of thing. So Lucille and the kids are completely spooked by this, and she calls James at work immediately. And, you know, James is listening to this, and he's kind of like, look, are you guys okay? Is everybody safe? You know, is there like an intruder? And she's like, no, just that this weird occurrence happened, right. And I can't explain it. And he's like, look, when I get home, I'll take a look, but I'm not leaving work for this.
Okay, buddy. Nice job.
So James, I'm not sure what he did at Air France, but he was a man of science. So he always believed there was an explanation for everything kind of thing. And he was taking the train back from New York. It was in the city, actually. I think I may have said that, New York City. So he's taking the train back from New York City to Long Island. And on that train ride home, he's just like, okay, what could have caused these bottles to lose their caps and pop? And, you know, he's thinking, could have been something, one of their chemical reactions, but then he realized that they're all different types of substances. So right.
The reason is ghosts, clearly.
But he also was like, well, his son was also really into science. So he was thinking, well, maybe his son had been doing, you know, experiments and maybe he mixed things and that just built up within.
That's what happened.
And then he just thought, well, maybe it's humidity, something's causing pressure. He's just thinking all rational things that most people would do.
Logic.
Brother. So anyway, he gets home, he inspects the damage, and no, like he has no reason. He can't understand how it happened. And he's just like, all right, well, let's just chalk that up to weirdness, that type of thing. Okay. And, you know, they go to bed. Next day, nothing happens. Day after that, nothing happens. It's kind of forgotten. But the third day, the incident happens again, almost identical. Kids walk into the house.
And the dad's
popping,
gone.
Dad's at work. Popping sound, bleach, detergent. This time nail polish. No. Shampoos again, starch.
Nail polish definitely does not pop, too.
And the holy water.
Again, the holy water? Yep. Is it a different bottle or is it the same
No,
one?
That's the one in their room. I mean, they put the caps back on.
They're going to run out of holy water.
The next day, happens again.
Ooh.
And some of the old were similar bottles or the past bottles and some new, right? And now James kind of like, this is crazy. Like this is now,
this doesn't happen three times.
Right. But he's focusing on his son because he knows his son is into science and he's thinking, okay, well, you know, maybe he's, and I don't know if this is because he had a science kit, but he was talking about these carbonated capsules that his son had. And then he's like, maybe he's timing it perfectly. And he's figured out that it happens right when he gets back from school. So he's figured out how to do it.
Yeah. Okay. How old is the son again?
He's 13.
I know a lot of 13. I don't know a lot of 13-year-olds. But if I did, I feel like they would not be. Okay. Sorry. Continue.
Well, I do. I myself, I remember what I was doing and how I did my radio and all that.
Okay, but this was like, oh, I guess it's the same kind of time period.
It's not unheard of. Like, you know, people are inquisitive.
I was thinking about Christian and I was like, yeah, no.
All right, well. So he now decides that, hey, I'm going to basically focus observing my son this whole weekend and I'm going to catch him tampering with these bottles. So he spends pretty much all of Saturday, Sunday stealthily, I guess, in some way, watching his son. However, Sunday morning, with James home, this happens again.
Oh, it's getting braver.
It's a bottle of turpentine in the garage, starch, holy water. And then he observes bottles moving back and forth.
By themselves?
And now he's, you know, he's baffled, but he's still angry because he's like, how did he do this? How did Jimmy figure this out and do this in front of me? So that's it. I had enough of your pranks. I'm coming. You know, he's super angry. So he barges into the bathroom where Jimmy's basically brushing his teeth, and he's accusing him of, why are you doing this? It's not funny anymore. What's the deal? And Jimmy's just like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm as spooked as you are. I had nothing to do with this. This is freaking me out, and I'm not at fault or the cause. And as he's having this argument in the bathroom, on the sink, bottles slide right off while he's brushing his teeth, and then kind of fall into the bin, the garbage bin. And then in the tub, the shampoo bottles come across and fall to the floor.
Ugh.
Right in front of everybody. So James now is like, okay, where are the strings? So he's looking, trying to figure everything out, looking for fishing line, whatever it may be, and finds out, nope.
There are no strings.
Nothing here. And that's it. At that moment, he calls the police.
Okay. So how about first they like leave the house and like never go back?
Well, he calls the station. The officer on call picks it up, and James is telling him and explaining what's going on. And the dude's like, put the whiskey down. Is this a prank? What are you talking about? Blah, blah, blah. And then he explains more about who he is, because he's a pillar of the community. And the officer's like, oh, okay, James, it's you. All right, fine. All right, well, we'll send somebody over right away. So they send an officer over, and the officer who's... The way I read it was basically this call goes out to the officers pool that there's this incident. And they're all like, yeah, not me, not me, not me. But the guy who gets it is just like, you've got to be kidding me, but whatever. So he goes there, and within minutes of entering the home and visiting the bathroom, bottles start popping again off their caps. Yeah. And almost as if they're directed at him.
Whoa.
So this officer's like, there's something weird here. We need a detective. You know, I guess this is just like, you know, basically the first level of police, you know. And they assign this to a detective, Tazi. So Tazi, again, is reading this report, and he's like, you got to be kidding me. And Tazi also is a skeptic, man of science, and he's just thinking of every natural reason or how it has to be human intervention.
There's a natural reason. It's ghosts.
Yeah. But he does keep an open mind. He's like, all right, I'm coming to investigate. And he asks, like, look, can I stay to witness these things if, you know, because when he first gets there, nothing really happens right at the time he enters the door. So he's staying now with them. On February 11th, a perfume bottle overturns in Lucy's room.
Those things are expensive.
With no one in the room. Well, I mean, 14-year-old, I don't know what kind of perfume they're buying, 14-year-old. But, I don't know if they heard a pop or anything like that, but I guess they heard the sound.
A crash, maybe?
Well, then he witnessed on multiple occasions the bottle of holy water, that cap popping off and falling over. Then when he would go to the room, like to actually redo everything and put the cap back on, the bottle would be warm to the touch. Yeah.
So, what is it like? Did they try like someone just holding it all day, like the holy water? Because that seems to be the constant one getting.
I don't know if they, I mean, or like the thing is, like, they could have, because they did. I don't say everything they've done, because he did a crazy amount of tests, and I'll talk about some of the other things as the public gets aware of what's going on. Mm-hmm. But on February 15th, their cousin visited, and she was middle-aged. I mean, much, you know, her name's Marie, and they're all watching TV. Mm-hmm. And as they're watching TV, a figurine slides across a table, rises up 2 feet in the air, and then crashes to the floor, but doesn't break.
Whoa.
Yeah. Not and a scratch on it. A figure, porcelain, I think.
Oh, my God.
So when this incident happens, the Hermans are like, and again, a bunch of others had happened while he was there. So Tazi's there, Marie's there, family's there, and like I said, Tazi tried to say, you know, is it this? Are there doors open? I mean, are just, you know, all crazy things. I shouldn't say crazy, but, you know, rational things. Mm-hmm. So now the Hermans, as much as James was in the family, is a man of science, he's also religious. So he goes to church and everything else. He contacts the church to say that this is what's going on. Could you please bless the house? And they're like, sure, we'll bless it room by room. So
right.
The father comes and blesses it. And by this time,
I feel like in these types of stories, whenever they get the house blessed, it just gets so much worse.
I think, well, I don't know if this was the act that made it worse, but to your point, it didn't make it better. but I don't know when they went out to how the news gets wind of this. And I don't know how that happens. Like, I don't know if it's because they talk to the church and just gossip happens, but now people are aware.
Really finding out about this.
Right. So it's now to the point where local news stations know about it. Reporters are starting to show up at the house, and they end up bringing cameras in to televise live feeds to see things happen. And
right.
I don't believe anything actually got captured on tape, but sounds of popping did happen off camera. And when they went to the rooms, bottles were knocked over, caps missing.
That's such a like trickstery way.
Right. And then with all these reporters and news cam, the nickname came out to Popper, the poltergeist. Right. So Tazi's still involved now, right? When this is going on, and with both Tazi, the police department, the Hermans are getting unsolicited. This is what it is. It could be this, you know,
right. And just people want to get involved.
Right. So they're trying to figure out what could be real, what cannot. And they are getting stuff from experts too. Right.
Right.
And then they're getting it from just, you know, people like us.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's like, you'd be like, oh, get out of the house. What are you doing? Just, you know, but,
yeah.
One scientist believed that there were magnetic fields from underground rivers that could cause this. So he actually brought they're like the metal wand things that you can use to find water. In
like
the ground.
A dowsing rod?
Yeah, that's the thing. And he brings it and they start looking at all the stuff and he's trying to point things and it's not kind of working. And then all of a sudden they go to I don't know if they went to the deed, registry of deeds or wherever, and they find out that there's no geography there. There's no rivers or anything like that. Oh. So it's not that.
Yeah.
Then James had talked to scientists at Air France and they're like, well, look, you know, unofficially, there are stealth aircraft flying around that do sonic booms that may be causing this. And
but it's only one house.
Well, they went, they looked at flight patterns. Yes, there was this ability that there could have been flights going there. But to that point of it's not happening anywhere else. Then this one person was talking about this. It was a woman from Revere, Mass.
Okay,
who just said, oh, my God, I've had something kind of similar happen to my house where furniture has been moving. I don't know about the popping, but things being knocked over and all sort of stuff. And they found out that the downdraft from her chimney was causing these things. And they ended up putting this damper or some kind of, they added something to it and that stopped everything. So Tazi's like, okay, yeah, that could be it. So they actually hire somebody to come in, put in this.
Wait, they didn't check first to see if the chimney was the reason before putting in this damper?
Well, this air was coming. I mean, I think they felt air or whatever it may be, but okay. The only way to stop it is to do these things. So they brought in this.
But did they actually observe like the air directly impacting all the furniture?
Again, they were just saying that this was causing it. So again, with downdrafts, I don't know if it happens in one room, happens in another room. It's just a matter of how air circulates, right?
Right.
So they fix this thing. And as the workers are leaving, all of a sudden, a figurine flies 12 feet across the room and smashes against the wall. Then.
Wow, that's such like a huge like, ha, like gotcha.
Then all of a sudden, they heard this loud bang in the basement.
No.
So Tazi goes downstairs with James, and as they go down there, and as he's investigating, James is on the upper steps, Tazi's downstairs, on the floor now, a 100-pound bronze horse moves across the room and hits him in the back of the legs.
Oh!
So,
like, fast?
I don't know if it, like, hurt him, but enough to, like, kind of be like, okay, this is a problem.
Also, it's 100 pounds. Like, that just does not move.
So with all this activity of people around, it just, now things are escalating. Things are becoming more violent. Figurines now start taking flight and almost aiming at Tazi.
Oh, my God.
Bottles would pop open in front of him, and the contents would spill towards him. Bowls would move and almost, as again, targeting him as well.
That's so mean.
So now the Hermans are like, okay, well, we should probably listen to Emma. We're just getting the hell out of here. So they leave and decide, because now it's become violent. Now, again, nothing has happened to them. It's been almost at Tazi only. Wow. So they leave, and Tazi's like, look, I'm going to stay. You go, I'm going to stay.
But if the violence is happening towards him, shouldn't he, like, get out?
I think he's, again, he's just trying to figure out what is going on.
It's ghosts. I solved it. Now leave.
They leave. Family leaves. And as while they're gone, nothing happens. No movement, no popping sound, no nothing. And this goes on for, I think, a few days.
Weird.
I think 3 days. So Hermans return.
And almost immediately it starts up again.
And on February 24th.
Yep.
Things escalate even more.
Wow.
This time, Tazi hears a loud bang come from Jimmy's room. And he's so startled by the sound that he runs up to investigate, that when he goes into the room, there's no one there. And I don't know if they were all home or if they were downstairs or if the kids were still at school. Mm-hmm. And the bookcase in his room had toppled over. The following night...
Sounds like something that happened to me.
Well, that's because you're climbing it. The following night, Jimmy was doing his homework in his room when the record player in his room rose up in the air and flew 15 feet across the room. At almost immediately at the same time, in the master bedroom, a small statue of the Virgin Mary flew across the room and crashed into a mirror, shattering the mirror.
No, that's bad luck.
And then, well, I think they already have the bad luck.
Luck for the poltergeist.
And then another bookcase fell over. And in the dining room, the centerpiece rose up and flew and hit the cupboards.
This is all at the same time?
I think the stuff upstairs happened and then it came downstairs. Ooh. Because Tazi then comes downstairs. And as he's coming downstairs, there was a globe and that flew across the room, almost hitting Tazi.
Oh.
So by this time, too, there were reporters there, you know, in the house visiting here and there. So
they were just letting people, like, in the house?
I think, depending. I don't think it was, like, all the time. But I think... this is not the same night, but maybe the next day. There's a reporter now in the house. And as the reporter is sitting there, I think he's fiddling with his camera. He watches the flash bulbs on the table levitate in the air in front of him and then smash against the wall.
No! Right?
So he didn't get the picture. And now Popper is not only doing that, he's now knocking on walls to get attention, knocking on doors,
Popper,
knocking on the floor.
Just leave.
By this point, it's national news. They had a reality show where they had the cameras in there. Dr. J.B. Ryan, who I think we spoke about some time in the past at Duke University's parapsychology department. I feel like we've brought him up in the past.
Sounds sort of familiar.
Is now contacted. And they focused on these types of things. And I think, again, I can't remember which poltergeist story we had done in the past, but the studies they had done, they believe that humans under the right circumstances could influence the movement of objects without touching them.
Like a Matilda scenario?
Psychokinesis.
Right.
So they are believed in the science of psychokinesis, or pseudoscience, I should say. So on the 26th, they send a Dr. Pratt to the Hermans home. And the Hermans are like, please come on in. Just like, come on.
Help us.
Exactly. And, you know, he explains psychokinesis to the family, and he says, well, it usually revolves around a girl who's just entered puberty. And Tazi's like, well, look, I understand. And yes, there is a girl in the house. She's 14. But 75% of the incidents that I've seen or have been involved with have been around Jimmy. So Pratt is like, okay, well, then let me focus on Jimmy. And he ends up, you know, spending a lot of time with him. You know, he's playing cards with him. He's helping him with his homework. He's got his own tutor, I guess, now.
That's nice.
And doing all these little
things.
Having,
like, a whole scientist helping you with your homework.
And during this time, nothing happens.
Ooh.
Yeah, nothing. So Pratt asks another colleague to join him, a William Roll, who I also think we've spoken about somewhere else. And they both interview the family. They interview Tazi, any other witnesses that may have seen, you know, reporters, things like that. And while there's this lull that with nothing happening, both scientists have come out to the papers and to all their news saying that this is not a hoax. You can see it in their fear in our interviews. Everybody's corroborating it. This is not a hoax. There's something going on here.
Oh boy.
So they state this out. It's now all over the papers that there's this thing going on.
And it's not a hoax.
Exactly. I'm waiting for the Warrens to show up.
Yeah.
On March 2nd, Popper's back.
Any reason?
They're both there now, Pratt and Roll. A dish flies across from a kitchen cabinet, shattering on the floor. Bottles popping open. And then the night table in Jimmy's room flips over.
Okay.
A couple of days later, on the dining room table, a vase of flowers slides across the table and then rises up in the air.
Oh, I don't like that.
And then in the basement, a bookcase falls over.
Oh my God. Right?
On March 10th, the last incident happens.
There's no...
And this is what the weirdest thing. So James is away, okay? He's not there now. He's on a business trip. Pratt and Roll are sitting in a living room when they hear loud popping sounds in the cellar. They rush down to investigate, and they find that original bleach bottle moved from where it was with the washer dryer mm-hmm. onto a cardboard box, and the cap popped off. Not spilled, just popped off.
Whoa.
They stayed for another week. Nothing else happened.
Nothing.
That's
like the last thing that it did.
That's
a little underwhelming.
So, you know, they thought it was odd, and they were trying to understand this bleach bottle. It started with this. It was ending with this. They couldn't understand what's going on. They had recorded 67 different disturbances between February 3rd and March 10th. And investigators returned weeks later, months later, and nothing ever happened.
Did they move out?
They didn't move out. Steven Spielberg was 11 years old when he read about Popper the Poltergeist as it made its way at national TV. And then he later based that film, Poltergeist and the Freeling Family, on Popper and the Hermans. Wow. And to this day, it's written as the case study to Poltergeist and psychokinesis and all these other things. They couldn't understand if it was that James, with puberty and all, if it was just that that was the time, like he had entered, it was in it, and then, you know, his hormone monster, whatever, decided that, okay, you're good. But that's the thing that was about it. But I didn't know Poltergeist was
based on this story.
I feel like I knew
this story, but I didn't know it was connected to Poltergeist.
But that's the story of Popper the Poltergeist. And my song
is
Message in a Bottle.
I was just thinking about that the other day and like what we could use, like what story we could use for that song.
Yeah. I was like, everything that had something to do with pop was the wrong reason to use the word pop. And I'll just leave it at that. So,
and I'll leave it to everyone. Oh my God.
All right. So that's my story. Fun facts?
Yes.
All righty.
All right. So again, I'm using the fact site for this week's episode. And so my first fun fact is that this is kind of going back to my Mapping Moari story a little bit. Right. But it's like an anteater instead. The scientific name for the giant anteater I didn't think I'd have to pronounce this. Myrmecophaga tridactyla.
To Latin.
Yes.
And it means?
Ant eating with three fingers.
And you knew that, right? Just because of your Latin.
Well, I got the...
No, you just knew that from your Latin.
Tridactyla I got that bit.
You're supposed to say yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I actually got tridactyla.
5 years, right? And dactyl. I can't remember how many years you've done, but anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, the next one is that originally cigarette filters... I had to mime that for you because...
That wasn't miming. You're speaking and you're making noise. So just keep going.
Anyway, cigarette filters were made out of cork. And that is like now the look that they've incorporated into today's pattern. So...
Oh, yes. The beige part of it?
Yeah, I think so.
I didn't think you could actually suck out or get the... When you inhale, it gets... I'm shocked it actually would get filtered through the cork. I didn't think anything would be able to get through the cork.
I don't know. You're asking the wrong person here. I only vape, so...
Yeah, of course. That's great.
And my last fun fact, and I think it's my favorite one, is that in 1923, a jockey suffered a fatal heart attack during like a horse race. But his horse finished and won, making him the first and only jockey to win a race after death.
Yeah, I was wondering if that, if, I guess that doesn't matter. You just have to have something on the horse. So can horses just run by? I thought you'd corpse get disqualified. You're dead, so you don't win.
All right. Corpse on a horse.
I guess so.
Yeah, those are my fun facts. And do you want to say yours?
Sure. When I was reading about poltergeists in general, I found out that, so the director of Poltergeist's name was Toby Hooper, and we talked about Toby Hooper in the past because I think he
did your crocodile.
Well, right? He did Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and then he did the Eaten Alive when we were talking about true stories and things like that. But the reason he got the credit and why Spielberg didn't do the directing credit or direct for the movie was because he was filming E.T. at the time, and on contract the contract said he wasn't allowed to direct another movie until he finished E.T. So I don't know if it was in post or what was going on. However, he was on set for pretty much the whole movie, set up all the shots, did everything, and then
basically directed it.
Right, and then Hooper would just come in and then, you know, get the credit, and it worked out great. And I know you were saying, like, well, it's a great gig, and I think it was because Hooper, he did Eaten Alive, which kind of killed his career, so this was going to help him, because it was a Spielberg-produced film. But I believe with the way I read it was that he was also heavily medicated throughout, and it also, Spielberg was psyched because he wasn't messing up his shots, like he wasn't trying to do his own stance onto what he wanted. So it all worked out for all parties. But Toby Hooper has the directing credit on Poltergeist. Spielberg is just, I think, an executive producer or whatever it is. But the truth is that it was Spielberg that, you know, did everything on that.
Wow.
So yeah. So there's that other fun fact.
Damn. Right. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right, let's close it up for till next week.
Yes. So if you want to submit your own fun facts, like that one you just read out, I mean, it wasn't submitted, but if you want to submit one like it.
Yeah, I mean, Steve just sent it to me. He was like, oh, yeah, I know. I hear you're doing the story about
the two,
Poltergeist.
You were, like,
yeah,
texting, he's like, you know, yeah, casually. Nice.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Anyway, you can submit those to our email, which is everythinginpodcast@gmail.com. You can also submit them through our website, which is everythingpodcast.weebly.com. And also, if you have story suggestions or you have your own story that you've listened to that you want us to hear, please definitely submit those. Jackie actually texted me today with a story suggestion.
Oh, cool.
So that might be my story next week. We'll see. On social media, we are posting when new episodes come out and also images. So you'll see a lot of the stuff that we were talking about today. And you can find us on Instagram at @everythinginpodcast, on Twitter @between_podcast. And we have a Facebook group and page, both by the name of Everything In Podcast or Everything In Between Podcast. So definitely check those out. And if you are listening on a platform that allows you to do so, please, please, please rate, review, and subscribe. It's very helpful and gives our egos a nice boost. And then lastly, as we were just talking about, we pick a song for each of our stories. That's our episode title each week. And we've compiled those into a Spotify playlist. And it's called The Soundtrack In Between. Really good playlist. Lots of good music. Definitely check it out. Good road trip playlist. Good study playlist. Good playlist for whenever, you know? So definitely check that out. Give it a listen. And I think that's it. So until next week.
Till next week.
Bye.
Bye.